Well, welcome to the Get Fit with Dodo podcast, and grab your pen and paper and get ready to take notes and learn from one of the greats, because Dr. Raymond Peet is back again answering your questions and mine today, because I have questions today. So if you're not familiar with Dr. Peet, he's been on the show several times and we all love him. We love to learn from him. You can find out more by visiting raypeet.com. That's R-A-Y-P-E-A-T. And I highly recommend checking out his articles, his blog, and also his newsletter. So you can get that by emailing raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. And so I'll have that in the show notes for you guys to check out if you haven't already done so. We're going to be talking about his newsletter that just came out last night. As soon as I got it in my email, I was like immediately reading through it. Best newsletter so far that I've read of Dr. Peet. So we're going to touch on that today because it blew my hair back. So I'm so excited, Dr. Peet, to have you on. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
So yeah, I've got quite a few listener questions as well. And I've got my own questions today based on the newsletter and just some things going on. So I'm excited to get started. As you guys know, I've been banned from YouTube. So this is only available on audio. So be sure to share this with someone you know that's going to benefit from it. They're not going to find it on YouTube right now. They're only going to find it on podcast players. So be sure to share. And if you guys have more questions for Dr. Peet, I can't post like I was on YouTube and ask for questions. So if you hear this podcast and your question wasn't answered, just email me at getfitwithdodell@gmail.com and I'll be sure to get it in the queue for the next podcast. So let's start right off, because Dr. Peet, your newsletter was, like I said, one of my favorites. I lost my mom to cancer at 17. And what I do today is because of what I didn't understand about her health and how to help her, because I was so young. And she did all the mainstream cancer killing therapies. And after watching her go through chemo, surgery, radiation, more chemo, then finally out of desperation, alternative treatments out of Mexico that didn't work because her body was too wrecked from the cancer killing therapies, I'm convinced that it was the therapies that killed her, not the cancer. And so when I read your latest newsletter, the carcinogen metabolism, it was just phenomenal. Like one thing that you said in the newsletter really jumped out at me. There are many substances that can inhibit the inflammatory degenerative processes acting at multiple levels. And these substances tend to be synergistic so that a great number of substances can be safely used at the same time. This kind of supportive therapy has nothing in common with the ruling paradigm of cancer treatment. It is reinforcing the organism's state of health rather than attacking the disease of cancer. That's what I want to help people do, is reinforce their state of health rather than attacking the disease of cancer. That's what I want people listening to this today to take home, is that there's a lot of therapies out there that are traditional mainstream, but there's also a lot of adjunct therapies that are synergistic and at least could support our organism and our host immune system while they're undergoing these treatments. It's not to say that people can't undergo radiation and chemo and things like that, but I think I agreed with you that they're attacking the disease of cancer rather than reinforcing the organism's state of health, which should be what's most important. So I just really like this. Yeah, go ahead.
They're a basic mistake. Mainstream medicine now for about 100 years has been committed to the idea that cancer by mutation is something alien to the human being. Mm-hmm. But the mutations are the attempt to survive and remain part of the human organism. They are our cells that are struggling. And if you focus on killing these cells that are already very weak and damaged, you forget that what kills them kills or injures the rest of the human cells. Mm-hmm. They are so similar. It's kind of like it's more possible to kill an invasive fungus, but still things that kill fungus or amoebas, for example, are always harmful to the human host. And if you look at the very few people who have studied untreated cancer patients, starting, as far as I know, in the 1950s, with the University of California professor Hardin Jones, he looked at people who, for some reason, refused treatment after being diagnosed. And these people almost always lived longer than the thoroughly treated people, the people who rejected treatment. And since those aren't taken into account, everyone who is diagnosed with cancer essentially gets the killing treatment. Mm-hmm. And if you really did a control, you would compare the absence of treatment to a particular treatment. But I've read through many volumes of the Cancer Research Journal, and invariably they fail to take into account the possibility that the treatment ever kills anyone. If hundreds and hundreds of articles absolutely insist that everyone who dies from cancer, they don't even consider the possibility that the treatments increase the death.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you're, like you mentioned, it's about reinforcing health. How can you reinforce the state of health in the organism if you're attacking both the good and the bad cells with some sort of therapy? It just doesn't make sense. And there's a big debate about out there about taking supplements when undergoing cancer treatment. But my job as a nutritionist is to support that host immune system and reinforce the state of health. And so there's this debate, like you can't take antioxidants during a radiation therapy or during a chemo treatment. And I can see both sides. I can see how, yeah, the supplement, depending on which one it is, could interfere with the oxidant support of the cell or the antioxidant capability that you're trying to kill off with the radiation or whatever. But at the same time, what about all the good? Like you've got this one little area that's cancerous, but you've got the 90% of you that's really good. Shouldn't we support that? And shouldn't we come at it from a standpoint of helping rather than harming?
Treatment industry has covered up the fact that there is no such thing as a purely local cancer treatment. For example, focusing the radiation beam, they say if we aim it at the cancer, the rest of your body isn't affected. But experiments show that, for example, they noticed that exposing mice to x-rays caused them to go into heat preparing to mate. Mm-hmm. And the explanation was that they had excited their pituitary. Mm-hmm. So someone did the proper control and irradiated their feet and found that that caused them to go into heat. Mm-hmm. And the same with any very serious damage to any part of the body. It spreads signals of the damage to all parts of the body. Mm-hmm. So that in Seattle, there was this idea of pregnant women who had a full set of dental x-rays. Even though they shielded their abdomen, their babies were born underweight, mm-hmm. showing that the stress damage signals affected every part of the body just from supposedly exposing the head and jaw to x-rays.
Yeah, no, you don't hear about this stuff. All you hear about is like the different doctors saying, oh, you can't, this is the only path. We only have this. This is our approach is like kill, kill, kill. And there's so many other avenues. Like I loved in your newsletter where you were mentioning things like mTOR and things that could inhibit mTOR include caffeine and aspirin and lidocaine and vitamin D and flavonoids. Like, can you briefly like fill us in layman's terms? Like how does mTOR work within some sort of like inhibitory action with cancer and why these things are important?
mTOR is a phosphorylating activating enzyme. Mm-hmm. And this particular enzyme activates all of the growth processes. Mm-hmm. So for normal growth, it's always acting, but all of the growth promoting factors have to know when to stop. And if you have stress going on, circulating lactic acid, for example, from any kind of systemic stress, lactic acid is enough to keep the mTOR activating growth processes without the appropriate need for it. And so lactic acid is carcinogenic by not allowing the body to turn off growth when it should. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that stressed tissues produce lactic acid, so you get a vicious circle.
Yeah. And there are, like you, I appreciated that in your newsletter, you did mention, I mean, there are some of the flavonoids known as antioxidants, like ascorbic acid and things like that, that they can become an issue, like reducing agents for stuff like radiation and stuff like that. So are there certain supplements that people can do if they've been diagnosed and they're undergoing these treatments, they choose to go that route? And are there different ones they shouldn't do?
The right amount, the antioxidants will actually be beneficial. But when they get inside the cell, a typical antioxidant like ascorbic acid or some of the flavonoids like quercetin are no longer reducing agents. They no longer are known by donating electrons, but they become oxidizing agents and keep the cell from having an excess of electrons. And one of the most basic features of cancer is that they have an excess of electrons. The presence of lactic acid in the system, for example, means that your cells have an excess of electrons. If you simply shut off the oxygen supply, you'll shift over to lactic acid production because electrons become excessive and will turn pyruvic acid into lactic acid. Mm-hmm. And with all of the cell activating effects. And so some very, very well informed leading biological thinkers are still confused on the issue. They still think that more electrons will be good for cancer patients. But in fact, the failure to oxidize, meaning that your cells have too many electrons, that's the essence of cancer and why the increase of lactic acid is universal. A feature of cancer.
Okay. Yeah. And so are there, so it's best to get flavonoids from food. I love that you said that in your newsletter. Are there certain ones, let's say someone listening to this has been diagnosed with cancer and they're undergoing, maybe they've chosen to go these therapies such as radiation or chemo. Where would you steer them? What protocol or suggestions would you give them to help them reinforce their state of health rather than just do the attack?
The reason doctors advise against using some supplements like vitamin E is that they are wanting to create free radical oxidation, which always results from an excess of electrons activating catalytic iron, for example, to create free radicals. I knew someone who was taking protective substances, and the doctor prescribed the standard course of chemotherapy and said it would be no more than, I think it was three doses of it. Absolutely three doses was all that would be needed. But after three doses, he said, well, we need another three doses. And after that three doses, he said, well, you need another three doses. And she said, I finally got him to admit that he had previously said only three would be needed. And he explained that your hair hasn't fallen out and you're not anemic. And those were the basis for judging. You have to radically harm the whole organism before you're satisfied that the chemotherapy is working. She ended up looking for thermotherapy, hyperthermia, to treat the cancer, which there's a lot of research showing that getting the body temperature up to just a little above 41 degrees Celsius will kill cancer cells without harming healthy cells. If you keep feeding the person so they don't get hypoglycemia damage. She went to a place that advertised hyperthermia, but the government required that they give a minimal dose, they said, of x-rays along with the hyperthermia. Mm-hmm. And after a couple of doses of the treatment, I got her to inquire how they were judging that she had reached a hyperthermic state. And they told her, oh, the computer does that. No thermometers involved, just absolute mystical computer knowledge. And then she asked, how many rads was she getting? And I think it was 800 rads to her whole pelvis, mm-hmm. which included the intestine. And she was getting classical radiation sickness, which sets in around a whole body dose of about 400 or 500 rads. Mm-hmm. So she had had about three times the dose that causes radiation sickness, and very quickly after that died from radiation sickness, not from cancer.
Yeah, it's like logic has gone by the wayside when it comes to our medical system. It's just like, it's just a sad approach, because I think there are protocols and suggestions that people can do to reinforce. So like in your newsletter, progesterone, and you mentioned vitamin D. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, both of those systemically lower inflammation. Mm-hmm. So they're just as good for treating COVID as for cancer or psychiatric diseases or a cold. Mm-hmm. Because what they do is turn the body towards healthy energy production through oxygen, and by reducing the inflammation, they are letting the body restore itself.
Wonderful. Now, go ahead.
Antihistamines are another pretty safe way to do that. And in a previous newsletter, I reviewed some of the articles showing the benefits of exercise.
Yeah.
And they found that the good things about exercise that help you maintain good muscles, good hormone balance, all kinds of good health points. They found that only when the exercise was sufficient to raise your body temperature did it produce that anti-inflammatory restorative effect. And if they raise the body temperature to that point, the same temperature that adequate exercise produces, they got just as much anti-inflammatory effect. So it's the body temperature falling below normal that is a basic activator of inflammation. And all of the major carcinogens, by reducing oxygen metabolism, lower the body temperature, and so necessarily result in systemic inflammation.
Mm. So important to keep that thyroid working and keep that body temperature where it should be in cancer prevention, then that sounds like. So going back to the vitamin D, I kind of had something I wanted to really bring up, because there's controversy out there. A lot of people are not on the bandwagon of vitamin D supplementation. They feel like you should just get it from the sun. But what about these, as a nutritionist, I'm seeing people that, as much as I would love them to go outside, they're going out covered up, they're wearing sunscreen, or maybe they're only going out long enough to walk around the block. So there's And not to mention the fact that there's published data that now there's nanoparticles being sprayed in our atmosphere that are blocking the sun's rays. So that leads me to believe that we do need some form of vitamin D supplementation in certain people that just will not go outside. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, are you for vitamin D with K2 supplementation, or do you feel like it should just be from the sun?
Ideally, it would be from the sun, but I've talked to people in Saudi Arabia and Latin America. There's a tremendous, like an epidemic or worse, of vitamin D deficiency in the traditionally Muslim and Catholic countries. Women in particular, well, the Saudi Arabians, even the men, were pretty much total body covers, but the women don't let any skin be exposed to the sunlight, and so they have a terrible vitamin D deficiency. The same in Mexico. People are, even the new generations that aren't following the prudish old cover-up practices, they have dark skin and don't want to get a darker skin, and so they just do for cosmetic purposes. I like to be protected from the sun. And I used to sunburn terribly from, I guess, my 20s through my 60s. Mm-hmm. At 7,000 feet altitude, I could get an intense sunburn in about 5 minutes of sun exposure. But after I started supplementing vitamin D, the next time I was in Mexico at over 7,000 feet altitude, I found that I didn't sunburn at all. I could work outside for hours without turning bright red. Mm-hmm. And I've heard other people say that when they take vitamin D, they can then expose themselves to the sun without burning or even just a moderate degree of tanning. Mm-hmm. So if you are avoiding the sunlight for some reason, then you absolutely need to supplement vitamin D. Mm-hmm. It turns on all of the protective anti-inflammatory processes.
I agree. I mean, I would love, like you said, ideally, I would love all of my clients to spend as much time outside as they can, but it seems like I can't get people to do that. So the next best thing is like, I find a good quality vitamin D to get them on. And yeah, like you said, myself included, I don't burn. Also, I think that's due to low PUFAs. I have found that eliminating PUFAs a long time ago, I don't burn. And I think that has a lot to do with the body's inflammatory response with the sun too, would you say?
Yep. Polyunsaturated fatty acids act as an antenna. Ultraviolet light excites those molecules, causes them to have excited electrons that then spread inflammation to other less sensitive substances. So they're like the antenna to spread ultraviolet damage. If you have a rabbit experiment years ago, they shaved rabbits and exposed them to ultraviolet similar to sunlight. And the rabbits that had a PUFA-free diet didn't get wrinkly skin. The ones on a high polyunsaturated fatty acid diet got very wrinkled after exposing their skin to sun, to radiation, ultraviolet.
Nice. Yeah, no, that's... Go ahead. What were you going
to say? Just that there are several things that will sensitize you, but a bad diet high in PUFA is one of the most age-promoting factors.
Absolutely, yeah. So I wanted to ask one more thing before we jump into questions, because in your newsletter, there was something that stuck out to me that I kind of just briefly touched on, but I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So you had mentioned that although the great majority of cancers have clear environmental causes, the carcinogenic pollution caused by governments and large corporations is ignored. And so it's like putting the blame on the defective genes of the victims. So I wanted to talk about the pollution caused by governments. Now, I had mentioned that I am seeing data on the fact that there is grid patterns in our sky. There's these clouds that make an X. There's lines in the sky that they're clearly spraying something into our atmosphere. There's published data on it. Do you think that this is something we need to be concerned about, that whatever the nanoparticles that they're spraying are dimming our sun's rays? And is this part of that heavy metal pollution we're exposed to, depending on what they're spraying?
That has been planned research for a long time. Bill Gates was one of the promoters of it. And when the public heard about it, they said, oh, it's just research. We don't really plan to go ahead with that. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe them. I'm sure they're continually working on it.
Yeah, I want people to be aware. I want you guys to start looking up and just doing your own research, because I think they've got us programmed to look down at our phones so we don't see what's going on in our skies. But I highly recommend checking out geoengineeringwatch.org, because there's a lot of published data there, and it's not conspiracy, because there's research on it. So just be aware, there's changes in our sky that are affecting our health too. And I believe some of that heavy metal nanoparticles could be part of that carcinogenic pollution that you're talking about too.
And one source of pollution that is often forgotten or covered up is that the Pentagon is the world's biggest single source of pollution. Mm-hmm. They can dump anything they want to, anywhere they want to.
Wow.
And they've killed and injured many military people. The Gulf War syndrome was just part of it. But burning toxic agents in open dumps when a war is going on, the soldiers are being horribly exposed to these toxins.
Wow. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to look into that too, because I wasn't even aware of that. So, well, I think we will jump into questions here because I could talk to you about this stuff all day, but I know everybody wants me to get to their questions. So Kylie is our first one on the list today. She asks, or she's kind of explaining that she has low TSH, free T3 is low, free T4 is low. She's tried Cytomel and NDT, but immediately she lost her period. It took her 5 months to get her period back while on Cytomel, but she was still hyper symptomatic, so she stopped it. She's had thyroid issues her whole life, so she's wondering if it was her nervous system that needed to adjust. Should she have stayed on it, or is there something else she should do, Dr. Pete?
It's important to know that the function of T3 partly is to improve oxidation that your liver needs to maintain the continuous activation of the thyroid and to make your liver able to detoxify hormones that are in excess. And so you can, if you have heavy menstruation or continuous hemorrhaging, you can turn it off quickly by increasing your T3 intake. But normally, the body produces only probably a maximum of 2 or 3 micrograms per hour of T3 by its own conversion from thyroxine. And people often, the worst thing is to start out taking maybe your whole day's dose all at once on an empty stomach before breakfast. And that for sure will give you the message goes to your liver that you have a gigantic excess of thyroid. And so you activate the liver to get rid of the excess thyroid. And that means that after doing that for a while, just a couple of weeks is enough to see it happening. Your liver, in just 12 hours after you've taken that one morning dose, your liver will create extreme hypothyroidism because it has learned to get rid of the excess. But then when you don't keep adding it, your liver pushes you to a very low level. And that's one of the reasons a mixed product like natural desiccated thyroid, a product like Armour Thyroid USP, for example, has a reasonable balance, the same balance that you would normally produce with your own thyroid, or a synthetic such as Seno Plus or Novotural are about 4 or 5 parts of thyroxine to each part of T3. So the T3 can activate your processes, and the T4 is available to continue to keep up your T3 level without at any time forcing you into the hyperthyroid state that you get when you take even 10 micrograms of Cytomel at once. Will give you the signal of excess that will lead to reduced thyroid function.
Yeah, and she didn't specify how much she was taking, so that's another thing. You know, maybe if she started with too high of a dose, and then also like since the NDT is going to have some T3 in there along with the Cytomel, maybe it was just too much for her, and she should just look at starting with like a really low, you know, 5 micrograms of the Cytomel or something. What do you think about that?
5 micrograms with a meal.
Yeah,
is okay. It's more than you would want on an empty stomach, but the meal slows its absorption over a period of about 2 or 3 hours, and it's very important to check things like your temperature, pulse rate, blood pressure, and so on, and to not expect things to be normal immediately. Watch for changes to gradually increase over a period of 2 weeks or more. And many people want to see quick results, and that leads up to getting very disturbed ups and downs of the metabolic rate, and makes it very hard to find the right level. So traditionally, people who had really studied thyroid function, like Rhoda Barnes, would take several months, usually, to determine what their correct dose was. And the correct dose varies typically fourfold just by seasonal changes in day length. I found that in the winter, I needed 2 grains of Armour Thyroid to maintain my temperature and heart rate. And that gradually, starting in the spring, decreased to 0.5 grain per day to maintain the same level of function and metabolic rate.
Nice. Yeah, that's it. I like that you mentioned the part about her taking it with a meal, because I think there is a misconception out there. I mean, most thyroid medications are told to take, you know, on an empty stomach, right when you wake up, 20 to 30 minutes before eating. And I like that what you're saying is they really need to take it with food. I've always thought that would be more efficient, slowing down how quickly it's absorbed. And so that makes a lot more sense than on an empty stomach.
I'm sorry. heard practically all pharmacists and doctors give that take it on an empty stomach in the morning recommendation. But I tried to find out what their reasoning was. There is no reasoning. They based their thought on how do you get efficient absorption. They want to think about not wasting any of the thyroid. So you do get the full amount that you consumed if your stomach is empty. It shows up in your bloodstream right away. But the thyroid never works that way naturally. It seeps out as you need it. So if you have enough food to keep your blood sugar up and your stress hormones low, your body will continue to convert thyroxine to T3 exactly the right amount, but it's a continuous moment-by-moment process. It's absolutely without any biological sense to recommend taking your day's dose on an empty stomach.
Okay. So next question, Zed asked, okay, this is kind of a long question here. So Dr. Pete was asked in the past if he believes one can regrow hair back to their juvenile hairline. He replied that it may not be possible. I would love to know if someone was willing to dedicate all of their time to this, this is a cool guy, what further steps could be taken after addressing TSH, temperature, vitamin D, and calcium? For example, microneedling, scalp massage, or even, you know, hanging upside down, maybe a high dose of vitamin K to decalcify the scalp, anything that he thinks could help. Thank you so much.
Scalp massage definitely helps hair loss from a variety of causes. Even alopecia areata can be helped by massage, even though that's an autoimmune spotty loss of hair. The massage helps to normalize getting the cell energy back up. But I've never known any single individual who wanted to put in the necessary time. It really could involve basically everything you do, but it isn't benefiting only your scalp, because people, you've probably heard of the ear lobe crease. Mm-hmm. People who are bald have a very high incidence of a crease across their earlobe, and that crease happens to be an indicator of susceptibility to heart disease. And so there's a known association between circulatory system health and good hair growth. So the things that help to restore the health of your follicles are also helping every other part of your body.
I love that. I think it goes back to like grandma's logic of like brush your hair 100 times, because people, I think they're afraid when you're losing your hair, you're kind of afraid to brush your hair because you think you're just going to brush it and pull it out. But just brushing your hair, like a scalp massage, or, you know, there's a company that makes a derma tool for your head where you just kind of like stimulate the scalp. I think those are going to be more beneficial, because what you're doing is you're drawing blood to that area, increasing circulation. So, you know, like brushing your hair, you might lose some hairs the first few times you do it, but then you're going to start stimulating that blood flow and hopefully improving the hairline as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and putting your fingers on your scalp without moving them against the skin, but wiggling your fingers so that you're moving the skin around, that kind of 15 minutes per day of that amount of massage can very significantly improve hair growth. Getting your temperature up to normal, I think, is a big part of it. I looked at the normal range of temperatures in the brain. And it happens that the highest temperatures are towards the middle and rear of the brain, and that for best functioning, the highest part of the brain, the frontal lobes of the cortex, have to be slightly cooler than the central part of the brain. They have to be able to be quiet rather than overactive. And the hair cover on the top and back of your head is helping to insulate your head so that you don't lose temperature so easily where you have heavy hair growth. But the fact that hair doesn't grow on the forehead is probably associated with the fact that your frontal lobes should be cooler. And so your forehead is like a radiator that helps to maintain that gradient of temperature inside your brain, optimizing your prefrontal cortex functions.
Well, I really love that my brain is really warm right now, because you make me think so much. So like just listening to you share that your knowledge like makes my brain like feel warmer. So that's cool. Okay. So Zed had one more question in his email. He said, when my heart rate increases after exercise gets a little strenuous, the inside of my nose becomes very cold and painful to breathe through and almost closes up. Does Dr. Pete know what could cause this and how to avoid it?
Yeah, that's too much adrenaline. I used to notice that if I was in a study project, for example, and went too long drinking coffee, I would get that sensation that my nose membranes dried out and cooled, and my sinuses extended that feeling of too much air in contact with them. And, I think it's that the high adrenaline simply reduces circulation to your nose and sinus membranes.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like maybe his exercise, maybe not as strenuous, maybe just moving your body without getting too much adrenaline going, yeah?
Yeah, not doing things that are tend to raise your heart rate too much, but the kind of muscle exercise that heats up your muscles, and then they heat your whole body and mm-hmm. increase the temperature. So lifting weights or using dumbbells enough to warm up your muscles, raise your body temperature, won't necessarily make you breathe any harder.
Yeah, excellent. I love that. Okay, so I can't pronounce this name, but it starts with a K, and it says, what are Dr. Pete's thoughts on high-dose vitamin E? Is it safe to take up to 3,000 IUs per day? Thank you.
There have been tests, and it was right around 3,000 or 4,000 units a day that would cause the vitamin E to produce diarrhea. It was simply a physical overload that probably irritated the intestine, and they found that you couldn't absorb above a certain limit. It produced diarrhea and was useless, but they didn't see any damage from doses up to that point. But you have to remember that the products they call vitamin E has changed pretty continuously through technology from the 20s and 30s, when it was known as a fertility vitamin. That's where the name came from, tocopherol, offspring bearing. And so a deficiency was defined as the sterility level. And that worked because vitamin E protects against estrogen. Estrogen is the anti-progesterone, anti-fertility agent. And so progesterone and vitamin E were found by the late 1930s to be working together to protect against estrogen, and so to improve fertility, and as a side effect, many other changes. But at that point, for various reasons, the estrogen industry didn't want vitamin E to be known as an pro-fertility anti-estrogen chemical, so they promoted the idea that it's nothing but an antioxidant. And so for years, vitamin E was defined as its antioxidant potency, which corresponded to the D-alpha tocopherol concentration. And the total vitamin E effect was considered only the antioxidant potency. And for a time, the vitamin E value was defined as the D-alpha tocopherol content. Now it has changed again, and so they specified the proportion of all of the isomers of vitamin E. And the definition has changed, and along with it, the way they prepare the vitamin. And so it's the way it's prepared is extremely different. For example, the octicosanol portion used to be a major part of the function, and now that is removed, changing the consistency of the vitamin E and also apparently reducing its biological values. So that starting 20 or 30 years ago, there has been a campaign to warn people about the potential dangers of high intake of vitamin E. And since the benefits were established with different products and different definitions about 60 or 70 years ago, we don't really have any good research evaluating what's going on with present products of vitamin E. So I think it's best to be very cautious with your dosing.
Very good. Okay, so Dopa Siva, or Dapo Siva maybe is the name, asks about blackstrap molasses, unsulfured. Is it a good source of carbs, potassium, and minerals? Thanks a million.
Years ago, I noticed that it had sort of a smoky taste, and so I investigated how it's made. And when you put your crude cane juice through the crystallization process, the brown stuff, gradually it doesn't crystallize. And so as you crystallize the pure sucrose molecules, you're separating a gummy brown substance. And it turns out that the standard way to make sugar is to burn the cane fields and then to cut down the bare stalks and grind that up to make your cane juice. And if you burn the cane before you extract the sugar, you're going to get a lot of smoky material mixed in with the various nutrients that produce the brown stuff. And so heat, overexposure to heat, will also cause the amino acids in the natural cane juice to react with the glucose in the juice. That produces toxic brown material. And so the brownness at least reflects the heat breakdown products involving amino acids, and probably most often involves some smoke resulting from burning the cane. So the fact that a lot of people have an allergy-like reaction to box trap, I think, could steer people away from it.
Okay, good to know. All right, these last couple of questions here we'll take, and then we'll save the rest for next time since we're running short on time here. But these last questions are related. They're both asthma questions. So Constantine asks, hi, Dr. Pete, I'm a 23-year-old male, and I've had bad asthma since I was 2. My asthma is serious enough that I need to use some type of inhaler daily. When it's very bad, I use an inhaled corticosteroid. And when it's more manageable, I use a rescue inhaler that is androgenic agonist. I know these are both harmful drugs to use daily, so I would very much like to get off of them. I've been experimenting with cyproheptadine, pregnenolone, and progesterone as alternatives, but none have been able to prevent me from needing my asthma inhaler. Do you have any ideas on what I can do to get off the inhalers, or alternatively, on what I can do to mitigate the harm done by using the inhalers?
Checking your foods, a very careful elimination diet can usually identify foods that make the symptoms worse. By stimulating different parts of the intestine, researchers have found that you can produce all sorts of psychosomatic conditions, everything from asthma to migraines to epilepsy that can be provoked by irritating certain parts of the intestine. And so constipation, diarrhea of some types, and anything that tends to cause pressure or irritation in the lower intestine is a major cause of asthma. And so looking for foods that are hard to digest, you can often get a good diet by eliminating certain foods. For example, green salads, lettuce, or spinach leaves that aren't cooked are extremely irritating to the intestine, promote bacterial growth, endotoxin production, as well as just direct irritation from the nature of the leaf. And sometimes simply eliminating salads and undercooked vegetables will do it. The right kind of fiber will sometimes stop the whole problem by getting food to move through you faster before it can reach that degree of pressure and irritation.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I would definitely second that. The gut is always a good place to go when dealing with anything that's, you know, causing a reaction in the body, as well as how about balancing blood sugar? Do you think that would matter if he's going a long stretch of time without eating? Would balancing his blood sugar, would that help the body calm down too?
Exactly. Both the chemical irritants and the mechanical irritants are ineffective if you have high blood sugar or adequate blood sugar. Mm-hmm. But for example, if you have an inflatable balloon in the animal's intestine, and the animal has good blood sugar, if you blow up the balloon, nothing happens. But if its blood sugar is a little on the low side, when you blow up the balloon, you can produce instant asthma symptoms because the autonomic nervous system is destabilized by low sugar. Same with allergens. Low blood sugar makes you allergic to more things.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. So Ruth also asked a question on asthma. She said, what are Dr. Pete's views on the use of those inhalers? Her sleep is interrupted by hot flashes throughout the night as well. What are your views on inhalers and why her sleep is interrupted by hot flashes?
What is interrupted by the hot flashes? Sleep?
Her sleep is interrupted by hot flashes throughout the night.
Progesterone, by maintaining your body temperature and oxygen use during the night, will improve the depth and restfulness of your sleep. If your progesterone is low, and usually if your thyroid is low, your blood sugar is unstable, falls too low during the night, mm-hmm. and will trigger all kinds of symptoms, hot flashes, night sweats. Nocturnal asthma and nocturnal epilepsy are very well known consequences of the falling blood sugar during the night. Painful things become more painful at night because of falling blood sugar.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely the progesterone can help with hot flashes just in general in the night. So there was something else that you said that made me want to, what were you going to say?
Experimenters have used something like a cup full of cornstarch as a way to give pure carbohydrate at bedtime, and I found that even though that was not good nutrition, it would prevent the hot flashes by giving you a constant supply of glucose during the night.
That's so interesting. Like I've had myself included, people mention that corn in general, it seems like they sleep better when they have corn for dinner. Do you have any thoughts on this? Because I don't really love corn for the fact that it seems to be a food that can elevate blood sugar sometimes too high in certain people. But you know, I'm hearing that it actually can help with sleep. Would you have any reason why?
It doesn't have, for example, gluten. If they're eating corn, they might stop eating so much wheat and gluten. And especially if the corn is in the form of tortillas or lime processed corn, that becomes very anti-inflammatory. Just having some oat bran, oatmeal, or oat bran mush at bedtime, those are often very protective, keeping your blood sugar up.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I don't have corn very often, but I find that if I have it for dinner, like you mentioned, like homemade corn tortillas or something, it's like my sleep is just phenomenal. So I find that interesting. Okay, that's all we have for today because we'll wrap up here and we'll save the rest for next time. But Dr. Pete, this is always so enlightening and educational, and I love hearing your views on so many different topics. So we'll get to more questions next time. But you guys check out his newsletter. That's raypetesnewsletter@gmail.com. If you missed this one, if you haven't signed up yet, I highly recommend going ahead and ordering it and maybe just shoot him an email. And I bet they'll send that one to you that they just put out because it is really excellent, Dr. Pete. That carcinogenic metabolism was really a big eye opener. So thank you for that. And thank you for being a part of this today.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye for now. We'll talk soon. Hey guys, are you in the Midwest? Are you in the East Coast? Are you in Brazil? Are you in Asia? It doesn't matter where you are. I would love to work with you as your nutritionist. And so just to let you know, I offer nutrition consulting worldwide. You can work with me anywhere. I have clients all over the world and I love to spend time over the internet with each one of them, figuring out their specific needs. So your specific needs, what deficiencies are you having? What symptoms are you dealing with daily that we can address for you? So that's what I, as a nutrition detective, like to get to the bottom of. I ask you a ton of questions. We meet over Zoom or over FaceTime, whatever's convenient for you. And we discuss all of your specific needs. If you would like to work with me, just shoot me an email, getfitwithjodell@gmail.com. That's getfit, getfitwithjodell@gmail.com. And let's set up a 15-minute free call for you just to see if I'm a good fit for you as a nutrition therapy practitioner. Again, email me, getfitwithjodell@gmail.com, and let's get you set up feeling better, lose that unwanted weight that you have going on, lose those symptoms that you have hanging around, and optimize your health as best we can. So a common question I get is, what are some of my favorite supplements that I take daily? Well, here are my faves, just to name a few. I love a good magnesium glycinate for stress and sleep. I love a good multi-mineral to make sure I have all the raw materials for my thyroid and my metabolic processes. I like BCAAs, branched chain amino acids, when I can't get to adequate protein in the midst of a busy day. And I never go a day without my vitamin D3 and K2 drops under my tongue. You know, supplements can be pricey, and in a perfect world, wouldn't it be nice to have a healthcare practitioner assign your specific supplement needs to you and find the one bio-individual supplement needs that match your body? Well, that's where FullScript comes in, my online supplement dispensary. FullScript is where I can recommend the perfect supplements for you when we consult, but also if we don't consult, you can simply go to my FullScript online dispensary and find all of your favorite supplements at 15 to 20% off what you would normally pay in the store. So FullScript has lots of my favorite brands like Quiksilver Scientific and Nutrisol and Apex Energetics and so much more, hundreds more in fact, even protein powders, teas, toothpaste, and natural beauty products. Really great brands that I myself love and recommend. So to try my FullScript out for yourself, here's a couple of options. You can, number one, click the link in the description to visit my FullScript page, or you can enter us.fullscript.com/welcome/jfitzwater. Let me say that again. That's us.fullscript, FullScript.com/welcome/J as in Jodell Fitzwater, FitzWater. Or if that's too long and lengthy, you can email me at getfitwithjodell@gmail.com and I can set you up with a free FullScript account where I can help navigate the right supplements for you. So FullScript is discreet with fast shipping that drops right to your doorstep. No more running out to the local natural health food store when time's just not on your side. The world does not offer enough raw materials naturally anymore to combat the modern stressors. And that's why finding the right supplements that work can and will help you. Try my FullScript today, save money, and start feeling better. Kind of simpleton, really, but I will say when it comes to skincare and hair care that there are a couple products that I can say have really moved the needle for my skin and hair, and also are easy to use, they smell fantastic, and they're all natural, and that is Anne Marie Gianni skincare and hair care. Anne Marie Gianni is a wildcrafted herb-based skincare line, and recently they've launched a new shampoo and conditioner line, which is phenomenal. My hair has never felt better. So if you're looking for really great wildcrafted herbal-based skincare, I can't say enough about Anne Marie Gianni. I love their charcoal mask and their pearl illuminating mask. I'm a sucker for masks whenever I just want to feel like I'm having a spa day and giving myself some vitamin P, right? And so
This is something you can get really inexpensive. They've got a nice little trial kit you can pick up for as little as $19.99, and it comes with a slew of little tiny travel toiletries you can take with you, from their cleanser to their anti-aging serum to the little masks. I love them. And by the way, you can also purchase small amounts of their shampoo and conditioner to give it a try before you buy the big ones. So check out Anne Marie Gianni Skincare. I've got a link in the show notes below. And